Hello and welcome along to the RTÉ Rugby Podcast, our first pod of the week, where we'll be picking apart where it all went wrong for Ireland in their first game of the Autumn Nations Series, a 23-13 defeat to New Zealand at the Aviva, and a game to come this Friday against an Argentina side who are flying it under Felipe Contepomi. That one looking more and more difficult by the day. We'll look a little bit closer at Argentina on Thursday's pod, but this one is a little bit more reflective on where things went wrong last week for Ireland. I'm joined by Johnny Murphy and Mick Kearney. Fellas, how are we doing? Thanks for joining.
All good.
Good, thanks.
Johnny, we'll break it down fragment by fragment, but I suppose the overall first question to start off was, where did it all go wrong?
Yeah, it was, you know, you kind of felt kind of watching first 10, 15 minutes was going to, you know, Ireland were in control to a point, and it felt that the atmosphere was about to kick on. And then there was just a middle stage of this first half that, you know, it just kind of lacked any flow to it. Ireland never really got into kind of any type of attacking kind of structure, really. And then the only time I felt that they got a proper kind of set together was the set just before halftime. And I felt they probably, if that hadn't been for a penalty, you know, they probably could have, you know, you felt that, right, they've hit their straps now. And to go in at halftime, kind of thinking, right, that's, they're in a great spot. They come out at halftime, start really well, score. And then just individual errors and the momentum just got, and their discipline at like real pivotal times. I know people say it come back to the penalty for, you know, against Finlay Beelum, but like there's ones, you know, before that and before and after that, like Beelum not rolling away is one that's a bit of a killer in his control. Henderson won again. That's a, like, they're massive momentum shifts. And then when we did get in good shape or good flow, like, you know, Crowley drops a ball just before he goes off, and they're actually in perfect shape. They have like two guys outside them. They have a runner coming short. They've Bundiaki outside that. It's kind of, it's like a 6v3 plus one, which is perfect what you want coming off a midfield ruck. And the ball goes to deck, and they just missed out those opportunities. And that was the way, I just felt that was the way it went, that all the momentum shifts, when they got an opportunity to kick on, they didn't. They just, there was individual errors, be it discipline, execution errors, that just shifted the momentum back in New Zealand's way.
And the discipline obviously is a huge one, and we'll kind of go into more detail on it. But like, as you said, they went, like, had to live a lot of the first half without the ball, and then in that 5 minutes before the break, they get some good possession together. Bundiaki and Caelan Darris make some big carries. You get the yellow card for Jordy Barrett. Jack Crowley tags over three, and they go in 9-6 down at half time, and come out in the first 5 minutes of the second half, Mick, and they're absolutely flying it. The halftime hasn't taken away any momentum. They've still got the one man up for a few minutes. They go out and they score their try. And at that moment in the ground, I was thinking, what this game really reminded me of was when they played South Africa at the Aviva, this time 2 years ago. And they'd been in a similar first half that had been just very, very close without too many clear-cut scoring opportunities. Granted, I think Ireland went in at halftime in the lead in that game, but they'd been under a lot of pressure and it was a very low-scoring game. But they come out after the break and hit South Africa with two tries in the space of about 5 minutes, and all of a sudden just had control of the game from there. And when Josh Vanderfleer went over and scored, and a couple of minutes later Ireland came back down and were on the attack again, in my head I was going, okay, this is what's happening all over again. But it's the losing momentum and the discipline, as Johnny said, where they got down into the 22. I think they gave away a penalty for James Lowe for a, it was like an arm around the neck around a ruck. And then 30 seconds later, just inside the halfway line, they give away another penalty and Damian McKenzie kicks it for three. And that just, it just killed the momentum completely.
No, completely. Look, like, I don't think you're alone in terms of the thoughts you were having just after halftime. You know, I think everyone in the stadium was probably thinking the same thing, and most people at home were thinking that also. You know, Josh van der Vlaar goes over for his try. There's obviously a really tidy set piece in the lead up to that, which I think would have given people a lot of comfort. Considering how things went in the first half, set piece wise to an extent. I was thinking we're on here. We're going to get into a bit of a flow for the next 10, 20 minutes. Discipline's going to be in a good slot, and we'll just kind of outlast them, I suppose. But unfortunately, it didn't work out that way in the end.
Yeah, and like even just looking through the basic enough stats that jump out off the page, Johnny, after the game, like penalty count 13-5 is the obvious one, but you've 21-14 handling errors, 11-10 on turnovers. Ireland 14 defenders beaten in comparison to 30 for New Zealand. One breakdown steal in comparison to New Zealand's five. There's so much there to pick apart, but one of the I suppose going through the big themes of discussion point that have been there over the last couple of days. One is selection, where I'd say a lot of people said Ireland looked, I'd say jaded is the word that it kind of felt like, but obviously we're so early into the season that it's hard to even say that. But I suppose maybe just as this whole team who've been around together for so long probably looked a little bit worn the other night. Discipline, obviously, as we'll get back to as well, and the set piece. But on the selection, it was obviously something we said on the podcast on Thursday when I was chatting to Bert, that obviously this was very much it was a selection designed to win this one-off test match on Friday night, and the bench in particular, that was a bench to see out a win rather than to get yourself back into a game. But if you could just look at, I had a look at it over the weekend. Ireland have played New Zealand six times over the last 3 years under Andy Farrell. Six players have started all six of those games for Ireland. Just four have started all six for New Zealand. In those games, Ireland have used 35 players. New Zealand have used 52. Ireland have started 24 players. New Zealand have started 36 across those six games together in the last 3 years. Does Andy Farrell just need to ever so? I'm not talking about rip up the play sheet. I'm not talking about send people off into early retirement, but does there need to be a little bit more bit by bit incremental opportunities given out here and there? Rest someone 1 week, plug someone in, test out a couple of little combinations here or there. Is the selection a little bit too conservative these days?
I don't actually agree with that. I
Okay.
do think that there has been a big change in selection policy since Andy came in, and he has massively broadened the net that was previously very tight in terms of, I'd say if you look at stats like that in terms of games like the big games that Joe was in charge, I'd say it'd be very, very, it'd be even potentially even smaller barring injury. The thing for me on Friday, I felt that it was a bit. There was a huge amount of loyalty in the selection, in the sense of probably the likes of Connor and Pete and the guys who are coming towards potentially, is this going to be their last time playing the All Blacks at home? And is it their opportunity to go out on a win like we all thought they would and give them that moment and that opportunity, given they've given so much to the red jersey? I'm not writing them off as in that's it, they're done now, but if you look at to the end of the season or past that, what's in store for players like that going forward? So I do think there was a massive amount of loyalty in the selection, but I do feel that a lot of guys were potentially undercooked in the sense of the amount of game time that they've had over the last probably 3 weeks, where you're going into a match against New Zealand, who are coming at the end of a season, who are incredibly battle hardened. And it's their swan song to end, and they know they're all going on holidays in 3 weeks, bar a couple like Jordie Barrett and the lads. But they're like, well, I'm just going to do this for the next 3 weeks and just get over, and then I can't wait to be on a beach or have a beer in my hand. So there is a bit of a thing where I think the selection last week was very much was a loyalty selection. It'd be interesting to see what happens this week and next week in particular around those stats that you're saying. There is an opportunity to give guys more game time and blood a few guys and look at different opportunities. Even I think in this Friday night, that is a cracker of a game. that we're under a bit of pressure now. But I do think there's opportunities. Like, I have no doubt that Sam Prendergast is going to get a cap over the next 3 weeks. If he doesn't, then yes, I would agree with what you're saying. You know what I mean? I think, is there an opportunity for someone like Gus McCarthy? Okay, he's come very quickly, but he's been on an Ireland emerging tour. He's played very well for the opportunities he's got for Leinster. He's in camp. Is it worth just throwing him in? He's played a decent amount of rugby. Okay, it's very, very early, but like, why not? You know, and I think there is an element. Andy Farrell has probably changed that view where, you know, 6, 7, 8 years ago, that didn't happen. It certainly didn't happen under Declan Kidney. It started to broaden a bit under Joe, but ultimately, I think Andy Farrell has definitely developed a much bigger squad than the previous two that have been in his job.
And Mick, like, I think we'd probably all expect that for the Fiji game the week after this, there'll be a lot of changes and a lot of players will get opportunities. But do you see much tweaking to this weekend's team? Because like, just to follow on what I was saying to John, like, one of the criticisms around the selection is that there are opportunities given out, but there are a lot of players in those squad, the likes of Cian Prendergast, Ryan Baird, Craig Casey. I know Casey started against South Africa in the summer, but that was when Gibson Park was away. But there are a good chunk of these players who their only big opportunities and their only starts in Test rugby in the last couple of years are coming against a Fiji or a Tier 2 nation in the autumn series, or against Italy in a Six Nations. That not enough of these players have experience playing against the top teams in the world. And ultimately, that's the reason why they're not getting an opportunity to start a game against the top teams in the world, because they don't have that experience. So is there a bit of a self-fulfilling prophecy there?
Yeah, like to Johnny's point on giving lads a crack, I completely agree with that. There's not, in my opinion, there's not much point in having guys in the environment if, they don't know that, or they don't think there's an opportunity to actually get in for the big game and, put your name on the jersey. I say that versus the kind of cohesion piece. Now, I know this group has spent a huge amount of time together. They haven't been together since July now. So, as we all know, you can train till the cows come home, but having that connection on the pitch and knowing what each other are going to do is extremely important. I can't see there being a huge amount of changes for Argentina this week. That's being totally honest, as you said. Like, naturally, there's going to be a bit of change against Fiji. With regards to, guys only really getting a chance against the Tier 2 nations, like, for me, it's a case that when they do get that chance, they just have to absolutely shoot the lights out. Have to take their opportunity, and they have to build that trust with Andy and the rest of the coaching team. So when it comes to the Six Nations, or it comes to the bigger November games, the coaches have confidence to put them in the mixer.
Johnny, like, when you mentioned, for example, that there were a couple of players that looked a little bit undercooked, and like, who specifically would you be talking about there, and what would the solutions be? Like, is the solution actually to get them back out again and get the confidence back up and get the minutes back under their belt, or is the solution to rotate people in and out?
Yeah, well, I think that, like, you know, the obvious ones are obviously the hookers. Unfortunate circumstance for Finlay Beelam in terms of the amount of game time that he had to get, given he had to go however long he did. That's just unfortunate. You know, obviously Pete's been out for a number of weeks. He got some game time against Munster the previous week. Not that he looked undercooked, but I'm saying there wasn't a whole lot of there, and he was coming off the bench to do a job and close it out. I think you probably do with someone like Kelleher. You probably give him another whirl. You know, in terms of getting his game time up now is going to be a good thing. And then it's what little changes he is. Does he look at someone like Jamie Osborne in the centre? And what Mick says around connections and having partnerships. You know, Jamie has that connection with someone on that partnership with someone like Gary Ringrose now. So what does that become, not that, Bundy in the first half was very good. Second half, he probably slipped off a small bit, in my opinion. But yeah, it'll be interesting to see what he do. I do think there will be some changes, though. I do think that there was a couple of performances that were probably not up to scratch. And it might be a week like the week that they had the first week in South Africa after the first test loss. People have spoken out before that they got a bit of a hairdryer treatment or a version of that that they've never had before, and they were a bit like, Jesus, this is, and they so I'd say there might be a small bit of that because there was some stuff despite obviously the shower just before kickoff, but there was some stuff that just wasn't, acceptable or wasn't up to the standard in terms of individual errors, and they were from key players in key positions. Like coughing the ball up in contact, getting it ripped in contact, simple passing, going to deck, throwing a ball. There was a lot of balls on people's shoulders when they were trying to run, like the Henderson one for Frawley, where they're trying to run lines, where the option is actually to go outside that. The person in behind that shape needs to be calling the ball to go outside, or whether they want to get it to Henderson's outside hip so they can inside hip so he can play a reverse play. But there needs to be, they just lacked a bit of cohesion across the board, I felt.
On that part then, Johnny, like the talking about the lack of cohesion and the error count, you kind of cited a couple of examples there. First of all, like Henderson getting a bad pass, but you were saying obviously that probably wasn't actually passing to him wasn't probably the right option in the moment to begin with. Were a lot of the handling errors that we've been criticizing over the last couple of days, were they coming from passes that probably shouldn't have been made to begin with? Or, were they from players who had been the wrong option to be passed to? Like another one that popped into my head while you were talking was early enough in the game when Bundyaki comes down towards the near side of the pitch and he's got this pot of three out the back and he tries to hit Caelan Darras fairly flat. And Darras actually gets tackled as the ball is coming into him and it's spilled forward. But if that ball goes out the back, there's probably like a 3-on-1 down the near touchline. Were there examples of that where the shape kind of was there, but the options taken were wrong?
Yeah, 100%. And there was a couple of things then as well that New Zealand did really well. If you look at the amount of tip-ons or tip-unders that Ireland had within kind of their three-man shape off 9 or 10, and the amount of turnovers that New Zealand got at that time, they were really smart and they cheated really well in that position. So the point player, what they do is the person who was passing, they turn towards the ruck in front of him. So that meant that they were creating a separation in terms of the their cleaners, which then allowed New Zealand either slow the ball down or get a turnover. And I think they probably won the attacking breakdown, where Ireland probably won the defensive breakdown in terms of, they were real pests in their second efforts when the ruck had been won and they got a couple of turnovers and a couple of barges, where the breakdown, New Zealand would just they just cheated very smartly and they got away with that, and that took away flow. Then there's individual stuff around pulling out the back. There was one a couple in the second half where there's a ball played out the back, it goes to deck. Mac Hanson had to go back and it creates a bit of confusion. They end up getting turned over off that and kicking the ball back. So there was definitely the right shape. And Crowley's one is the one that really sticks out. That knock on from him in the middle of the park, they have perfect shape there to attack. And that is actually a try scoring opportunity. And against New Zealand, you have to take that. And those opportunities that they got, they didn't take, based on individual handling and passing errors.
And then make obviously the discipline comes back around into it. If you had told us before the game that New Zealand were to score one try across the 80 minutes, I think we all would have taken that and we would have been pretty happy with it. And we would have been fairly confident that we'd be talking about an Ireland win afterwards. But 18 points off the tee for Damien McKenzie. There was, another penalty as well that came off the post as well. So realistically, you're talking about they gave him 21 points worth of shots at goal, and he took 18 of them. The frustrating thing as well is, like, we've seen it in the past this year with Ireland, where discipline has been an issue, and they're kind of conceding penalties in flurries, and maybe it's two or three in around their own 22. But in situations where they're desperate, and where in some situations giving away the penalty is actually the lesser of two evils, you might actually be preventing a try in the process. But what was a bit off-putting on Friday night was a lot of these penalties were coming 5, 10 meters into the Irish half of the pitch, or just inside the New Zealand half of the pitch, where there wasn't necessarily a huge amount of danger. And it wasn't like Ireland were getting themselves out of trouble. They were just putting themselves into trouble.
Yeah, completely. Look, I think first off, we'll all agree giving away 13 penalties at international level is, you're really going to struggle to come away with the result. Particularly, kicker of Damian McKenzie's standard. To your point, where the penalties are actually given away. So, like, sometimes it's just a case of a guy, not to pick on anyone individually, but just a guy saying, I'm just gonna go for this here. I'm just gonna stem momentum, and I think I'm right to do it. And it just doesn't come off. Find themselves in the wrong position. They lose their footing, or there's a bad entry to a breakdown, and before you know it, you're 6, 9, 12 points down. And it's just that compounding effect, and that's what the really good teams do. It's what Ireland have done in the past. South Africa are obviously masters of it as well. They just keep the scoreboard ticking, and you can find yourself under a lot of pressure very, very quickly.
Yeah, like South Africa, that's a great example, actually. Just South Africa on Sunday, even, is the perfect example, where I think they were probably just about second best to Scotland for large portions of that game at Murrayfield, and end up, outscoring them four tries to one, or was it even 4 tries to none, and comfortably win the game in the end. But coming back to Ireland, then the other element I know you wanted to talk about, Mick, was the set piece, which again has been a running issue for Ireland over the last year or so, and the line out in particular, 7 out of 10 against New Zealand on Friday. And even of the seven they won, a huge amount of those line outs were just uncontested balls at the front that New Zealand were happy to let Ireland have because they weren't able to launch anything from it. There were a couple of attempts at a maul, which didn't really move a couple of inches before Ireland had to use the ball again. So it's not just a case that the line out as such is inconsistent, but even Mick, when Ireland are getting into the positions where they can actually launch an attack, because they're having to go up to the front so often and teams are just happy to give that to them, they're not really able to launch a very dangerous attack.
No, for sure. And look, New Zealand are an incredibly smart defensive team when it comes to the line out. Like, you look at the four mans that Ireland attempted in the first half. Like, New Zealand are standing right beside Ireland. There's literally no gap. And you've a bit of a trade-off then. You either go for the line out to try and win it with no gap to keep the tempo that bit higher, or else you step out of the line out to make the ref aware of the fact that they're closing the gap, which just completely stymies any momentum that you would have had. Like, New Zealand sit, they'll sit deep, they'll sit deep, see, they'll sit deep defensively, so they'll have two pods around kind of 4 and 6 or 3 and 5. So it is hard to call against. I thought it was interesting to see Tadhg Burn calling. I know he's been calling for Munster, like, for a long time now, but calling is it's an art form in itself. I think really good callers in the past, like the likes of Dev Toner, the likes of Paulie, the likes of Dunica Ryan, like they're an island in themselves. They're almost like tight heads. I haven't met that many normal tight heads from a personality point of view. No disrespect to any of them. But I just think in terms of Tadhg calling, he's obviously found it tough the last couple of weeks in South Africa, calling down there at Munster. And I personally think it actually takes away from the rest of his game, you know, the ability that he has around the breakdown, the ability that he has from a carrying point of view. You know, and you can see with James Ryan, I think James Ryan has been incredible this season. And the calling's been taken away from him in Leinster. You know, Orji Steinmann's been doing a lot of calling. It's been, you know, he didn't do it with Ireland the last day with Tadhg obviously calling. And I think the impacts that James is having around the park as a result of that are phenomenal, particularly from a breakdown point of view. Like his ability to move bodies this season, I think has just been world class.
Would you have done much line out calling in your day?
Occasionally I would have called, but again, it wasn't something that I particularly enjoyed because it's just always on your mind. Once the ball goes over the touchline, you know, you're thinking about where it is in the field, you're thinking about how they might defend. You know, you're thinking, was my hooker down in the last play? You know, do I have to throw this to the front? If I throw this to the front, is that gonna have the 10 narky at me because he wants to go wide off this play? Like there's so many different factors that the lineout caller actually needs to think about. But then on top of that, sometimes lineout caller can just have one of those golden days. He knows the guy beside him is way slower. He knows that his hooker is just throws unbelievable darts. Like you look at the Gerry Flannery Paul O'Connell connection that they would have had, you know, Gerry Flannery just put it double tops every single time. Paul O'Connell unbelievably quick off the ground. So, you know, if they're ever unsure, or you know, there was that bit of uncertainty, the lads knew that they'd get out of trouble with a straight up a four call. Similarly to, you know, Victor Matfield back in the day, he only really had three calls. It was jump to his front foot, jump on the spot, or one step lob. Because he was surrounded by mutants, I suppose. That just meant, you know, he didn't have to go anywhere else.
And
On the gap, Nick, on the
Go ahead,
gap,
yeah.
like just in terms of that, are they not? I know you're saying it's messing up kind of flow in the game or momentum, but are they not better off? Because lineout is such an important, like you look at the first half, the second half, when just before Bundiaki holds, they hold up. They push him over the line and they get the momentum back and it goes to scrum, but that ends up in a turnover. But like that line out there is so important. Are they not better off just actually stepping off and going, "Here, ref, what's going on?" Like from a coaching perspective, is that something that just coaches don't want to happen as a forwards coach, or are you just like, "Look, we'll win in any end when we get on," or like is it just that balance about being ballsy, or when you go past that, you're being stupid, or how does it work?
To be honest, I personally every coach has their own, you know, has their own likeness on it. You'll see a lot of teams, they're actually jogging into lineouts now. You know, from about 10 yards out, they're jogging in and they're just gone in and out. Good luck. So that's why teams are closing the gap. Or you'll see, you know, one of the props or one of the second rows stepping across when teams are trotting in just to stifle that bit of flow they have. And look, it's easy for me to say from the cheap seats and in hindsight, but if the gap was closed on the first line out, I would have stepped out of the first line out and then I would have been teeing up someone like Caelan Doris to go to the ref and say, "Ref, here, they're encroaching in every line out. You know, we're trying to be fair here, but what's the plan?" You know, because like no set piece, no win. And I think the other night was the biggest example of that I've seen in a long time anyway, with regards to scrum and line out. Like if we can give the back line that we have there access to clean possession, which we've seen on a number of occasions, as was mentioned previously by Neil there, you know, off the top of the line out, really good carry from Bundy, Caelan Doris around the corner, and suddenly we're playing, you know. We're getting really good momentum. And you know, the All Blacks managed to get that probably on more occasions than we did the other night, in my opinion.
And Johnny, like I'd say, like as a coach, I'd say you've probably noticed this down the years with various teams that you've been involved in, where when you do have a set piece that comes under pressure, it's almost like that's an invitation for the opposition to go after it even harder. It's like, as soon as one team notices a little bit of a chink in the armor of a team's lineout or a scrum, naturally they're just going to go after it that little bit harder as well. They're going to compete a little bit more in the air rather than stand off and soak up the maul. They're going to go after the scrum a little bit more and try test them out. And that's where the nerves start creeping in, where as a hooker you walk down to the line and all of a sudden the target to aim for has shrunk completely. The lifters are just a little bit more wary of what they're doing, and everything just becomes a little bit tenser.
Yeah, 100%. And like lineouts are at that level are analyzed, so much that they're looking for all the different triggers and movements, listening to ref mics to see if they can pick anything up. So like if they have some type of triggers or tells or anything that they can get on, and then in a game they figure that out too, then there's a double down on that as well. So it affect not having a lineout. In this day, in modern rugby, not that they didn't have a line out, but creaking at certain times in certain positions on the pitch really affects the flow of the game. And like flow is being talked about all the time, but Ireland are very much, when they're in flow, they genuinely are the best team in the world. But they have to have those line outs to attack off, to give them those three or four power plays to allow them get in. Exactly like their try, exactly like what we spoke about their 5 minutes just before half time. When they get in that space, they're incredibly hard to defend. But it comes from having their set piece rocking.
One other element of the game, actually, Johnny, that has become a big thing now in the last couple of weeks, and it's something Bernard Jackman kind of warned us about this, that there was going to be this clampdown on it, and we saw it in real effect at the weekend, is the escort lines off the kicks. And I think New Zealand gave away two penalties for it during the game. Ireland gave away one penalty. We saw penalties conceded right across all the games. There's clearly a huge clampdown on this now from the referees. And it has the potential to be a game changer, even in terms of selection, because now you're at a point now where it's not just players are they can't deliberately block off, or like they have to get right out of the way, never mind just jogging backwards to clear the channel for aerial contests. How did you like I suppose how did you see that having an effect on the game on Friday night? And do you see it even tempting Andy Farrell into rethinking about the way he picks his wingers, or what he's looking for in his wingers? Because I actually saw someone mention it yesterday, and I thought it was actually quite an interesting suggestion. I don't necessarily know if I'm on board with it, but the idea, for example, of playing Jamie Osborne a little bit more at full back and trying Hugo Keenan out as a winger, because that's where you're seeing so many more aerial contests coming, for example.
Yeah, I think what it does is instead of there being, just from a viewership perspective, instead of a team potentially slowing the ball down to go into a box kick, instead of the crowd going, oh, they go, oh, right, okay, we're going to. And I think that the people are worried about safety. But if you have two guys who are going full whack and they have a contact in the air, they're actually less likely to get injured. Where the injury comes from, someone who then last minute pulls out and is only in at 90%, that's where the flipping and the tipping comes.
Yeah,
Yeah,
it's where one person goes high, one person goes low.
if they both go at it, try to connect, they'll just be hitting each other head on or shoulder to shoulder. It changes the game massively, and I think it's a brilliant thing. It's going to force teams to think about their backfield cover. Definitely comes into selection. Say, for instance, you look at the Australia game and you look at the impact someone like Swalehi could have on a game from the centre perspective. Like he gets up in a kickoff situation, he actually gets up and challenges Otoje, who's at top of the lift in the air, and he gets up unassisted and nearly knocks the ball back. Like stuff like that is going to be huge, and I think it's going to provide a contest that we've all kind of wanted. but definitely will be something that all coaches will look at, right? Where are we going to be guaranteed this ball? How can we put that in? How important are box kicks going to be to us now? Not just from an exit perspective, but if you from an attacking perspective, if you can get up and win a box kick, that momentum is unbelievable because all of your players are just going forward. And like people used to say about Johan van Gran, someone a coaching style like that now is huge because all his back three players need to be able to catch the ball going forward. South Africa are brilliant at it. I think it's a really good not change, but just interpretation that is changing, that is going to create a lot more contest, a lot more excitement, and make people in the backfield think a bit more. And will probably soften up defenses, I would think, because it's going to force them to have more people in the backfield. So instead of being 13-2, you might have to be 12-3 because you need someone, if you do catch it, to resource that ruck straight away.
And Mick, that last part that Johnny said is the bit that I thought was really interesting over the last couple of days, where like with all of these laws or new interpretations of existing laws, you always have to worry about the what are the unintended consequences of something. And I think one of the unintended consequences of this new interpretation of the escort lines and all this, which is kind of leading to more box kicks, is the opportunity where you're probably just going to have a lot more breaking ball around the pitch as well, where someone gets up and gets a hand on a ball and flicks it backwards. And I think even though some people might look at this situation and think, oh, well, this is going to lead to a lot more box kicks and I find box kicks boring, the reality could be it's going to lead to a lot more opportunities of transition and counter-attack, which are tremendous fun to watch.
Ah, completely. Look, I think, like, same as Johnny, I think it's a brilliant law change. Like, you're gonna see a lot of, as you said, a lot of loose balls. But I think what I've seen more than anything in the past is just some huge shots. Just some massive, massive shots being put in. Like around selection, if I was a coach, like I'd be picking the back three players with the strongest rib cage from what I've seen so far. Obviously, Randrandra got it wrong against Wales. He took your man's head off. But I think the intent from the defenders running through has been vicious, and it's been very nice to watch from the couch. And look, to your point around transition, I'm hoping that when those loose balls are recovered by whoever it is, the attacking team or the defensive team, the ball is just it's just gone through two or three sets of hands. We start to see a more open, free-flowing game. 'Cause that's what everyone wants to see. They want to be entertained. They want to see exciting rugby. They want to see the ball be put through the hands and quick rucks, etc. So, fingers crossed, that's one of the byproducts of this new law.
And Johnny, I'd say, like, as a coach, you're probably looking at this now as well, trying to figure out, like, where are my players going now? And you're trying to look at these matches and see it, like, for example, where in the past where you might have had a couple of back rows or a second row just jogging back slowly enough to just create a bit of traffic in that channel. All of a sudden now, if they have to get out of the way, where's the best place for them to go? And there's opportunities there now for you to be poring over film and seeing, well, what is this team doing with these players and where could these guys go to either put yourself in a better attacking position or a better defending position?
Yeah, and you're going to look at what teams, some teams now, and a lot of teams do, they have an attacking structure of kind of goal line dropout where the ball goes to the middle, they'll have a two-phase setup or a three-phase setup. What you'll look at is probably people being more prescriptive, which is actually a good thing in that, okay, well, whoever is the nearest forward or second row, New Zealand back in the day used to have off all kickoffs, near second row had to get to that ruck to then set up to play. You look at that, you'll also look at positioning in the backfield. Is it better off than having, say, the likes of someone who is incredible in the air, is a be and athletic, is it better off having someone like Ryan Baird in the backfield? Like, if you can have James Lowe getting up, catching the ball, Ryan Baird is there to secure it, or if he's there to get an offload or get, as you say, unstructured, Ryan Baird picking up a loose ball in an unstructured situation, that's incredibly exciting. So it brings loads of different dynamics into it. And, this is only the start of this iteration of this. So when we get to, what is Joe Smith going to do when we get to the Lions? Like, that's going to be interesting with the players that he has, and where can that go? And like, that's I think it's a really exciting of all the changes. I think it's something that's going to create a lot more excitement and a lot more, actually a lot more attack in the game.
Yeah, get a lot more transfers from Aussie Rules as well, with those fellas with their fielding ability as well. Andy Farrell can start tapping into Gaelic football a little bit more. Fellas, that's pretty much all we've time for. I do want to finish up though, on one last question for both of you, because I think this weekend, well, I reckon he's someone who's going to be in the news quite a bit this week and next week, because he was up for media yesterday, which is generally an indication that he's going to be involved this weekend. But Cian Healy, if he plays this weekend, will win his 133rd cap, which would level Brian O'Driscoll's record for Ireland. And I think we'd all expect at some stage over the next 2 weeks he will go on and set that record for himself. Mick, as a former Leinster teammate of his, and I suppose a fellow Clontarf man as well, what can you say about Cian Healy, who is now, I'm going to say, pushing just under 420 games of professional rugby across provincial and test?
Yeah, he's just like, he's an obsessive professional, yeah, that's that. To hear that, it's just unbelievable. Like, what a volume of games. Things have obviously changed for him quite a bit from when he started to where he has now, where he is now, even, two boys at home, and his wife Laura, and his parents have said they're absolutely swelling with pride. And so it's, I'd say he's buzzing for it. He was never a man who, looked at milestones all that much. But I'd imagine this is one that's been in the back of his mind for quite some time. So, if he gets in the mix this week, it's going to be fantastic to see him match Brian O'Driscoll's milestone, and hopefully he can overtake it in the weeks to come.
Johnny, like, even if you actually just think about it, where you've to what 200 and just over 280 games for Leinster, 133 by this weekend for Ireland. So realistically, they got to 420 games of professional rugby. Off the top of my head, four, at least four Six Nations titles, could be five. One of those being a grand, or two of those being Grand Slams. You've four Champions Cup titles, a handful of URC Pro 12, Pro 14, whatever you want to call them. There's, if you split all of that in two, there's enough for two highly successful professional careers, let alone one.
He's one. I think he's the only one who was on the Churchill Stags back in the day that is still playing. So for him to last that with how those old school tours were is kind of incredible, to be honest. He was on the tour to Denver in 2000, when was it, 2000, 2008, 2009, those kind of Churchill Cups when he started. He was part of that. The under 20s Grand Slam team that Ian Keatley, Earlsey, all those lads were on, Darren Cave. Only 2 years younger than me. It's incredible. But I think, as Mick said, he always was, someone that when he was on, and incredibly professional, his genetics, everything. He just, and his accolades, they're not enough for two careers. They're enough for nearly three or four careers, to be fair.
Yes.
Incredible. He's 100% going to go down as Ireland's most successful rugby player. I think with Andy Farrell, the likelihood he might be on the bench this weekend, but certainly it'll be something that if it's next week when he breaks the record, you would imagine that he'd be starting, and that he'll get to walk out with his kids and his family and enjoy a moment in front of his home fans. That's incredible, and it's been an incredible, and like, for him to come back at the stage of his career after the injury that happened before the World Cup, I think that's actually a testament to him more than anything before, because people were looking at that as if like, okay, well, surely that's it, so unfortunate type of injury, that stage of his career. And no, he doubled down and he's been incredible over the last, 12 to 18 months. So fair play. It's been unbelievable.
Yeah, and finally making him like never mind actually the trophies and all the caps. I mean, he has played minutes at least of Test rugby at loose head, tight head, and hooker, which there aren't many fellas around the world who've done that before.
Crazy. Just crazy to have that on your CV. Even, going on Johnny's point about the injury, to see him throwing the ball into the line out. Or yeah, was he thrown into the line out Murrayfield that time, or was it Josh
No, it
Van
was
Vaart?
Van der Vleer was chucking into the lineup, but Healy was packing down at hooker. And I think Ireland won a penalty off one of the scrums as well, I'm almost certain.
Right, yeah.
Yeah. He's just a freak. Just a freak of nature, physically, genetically, as Johnny mentioned there. Know everyone at Clontarf's extremely, extremely proud to have him associated with the club. So hopefully he can match the record this week and break it next week.
Yeah, fingers crossed. He gets on well this weekend, and I'm sure we'll be talking a little bit more about him again next week and in the couple of weeks to come as he hopefully breaks that record. Mick and Johnny, it's been a pleasure having you on the podcast again this week, and thank you for your time this morning. And I'm sure we'll speak to you again soon.